I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Shaughnessy Baldwin is a distinguished author who has written many critically acclaimed books, which have been nominated for many prizes. Her latest is The Selector of Souls. It is described as a haunting novel of extraordinary power that is timely. The book opens with a shocking act committed by one of the characters, Damini. Another character in the book, Anu, she leads a charmed, privileged life. However, she's also the victim of physical and emotional abuse. I'll get Ms. Baldwin to tell us about these characters and the themes explored in the book, gender, faith, and the new India that's emerged from the mid-1990s to today. Shaughnessy Baldwin was born in Montreal, raised in India, and now lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Her second novel, The Tiger Claw, which is being adapted into a feature film, was a finalist for the 2004 Giller Prize. Her first book, What the Body Remembers, was longlisted for the Orange Prize and received the Commonwealth Writers Prize. Visit her own website at shaughnessybaldwin.com. The Selector of Souls is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased to welcome in studio, as it were, to the Plant Online program, Shaughnessy Baldwin. Ms. Baldwin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, I haven't read the book. I haven't finished the book, I should say. I started it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I was really impressed by was the use of non-English and not italicizing it, as we see in other books. That was important to you?
Very.
Yeah.
Very important. We're in a very post-colonial era, and, of course, the italicization of foreign words has been a colonial construct for many years, and... But there are many other writers who've decided to move past that as well, and just to bring other concepts and terms for objects that don't exist in English into the language, because you have to reduce the world to English if you're going to do a novel in one language.
Yeah, I know. I don't speak the language, obviously, but it's not impossible to understand. Like, I mean, if you sort
it's
of
carefully edited.
Yeah, if you know what she's doing, say when she opens a cupboard,
right?
And then of course we have Google, and you can Google.
You can, and now you can even get images of the items in question. But
I
think the Indian words are only used when there isn't a word in English for it, or a concept that doesn't exist in English. And then, of course, they're defined very carefully in the paragraph itself, so you don't have to keep flipping back and forth with a glossary or something.
Exactly, yeah. Now, the time that this book is set, it's from the mid-90s to about the the last decade, you know what we call that, the first decade of the century.
Yeah.
What was happening in India
the
at the
noughties,
time?
Right?
Yeah. Well, what was happening in India at the time that I mean, it's a unique time. It's a time that's also transformative for India, right?
Very transformative. This is a time in the 90s when India was opening up, liberalizing, privatizing, globalizing, and nuclearizing. And so from 1994 to 1998, which is the era that the novel addresses for the most part, this was a time when fortunes were being made by people who already had fortunes, and then other people were just trying to survive. And so... At this point, it's a time of hyper-masculinization, where the feminine is being denigrated to such an extent that the masculine is coming more and more into valuation. And so the normal baseline sun preference that existed in India for centuries, because there is no social security, at some point began to turn into daughter aversion. And so this is a time when it became difficult for men to find wives, for example, and for women to justify existing.
So I guess families want sons, because presumably sons would find it easier to make a living than, say, a daughter would.
Well, and also help them in their old age. And
yeah.
This operates side by side with a taboo against taking from a daughter. And so the main character, Damini, actually breaks a taboo by going to live with her daughter in the beginning of the book. And her life changes as a result of what she does to keep the family going. And she has to, through the book, she has to come to terms with that and balance her karma. And so it's kind of a sin and redemption novel, but for a Hindu woman. So.
Now, the shocking event that happens in the beginning of the book, I guess we can we say what it is? No, we better not.
No, we shouldn't.
Yeah, so something happens.
It does permeate the rest
throughout
of the novel.
The novel, I'm sure. She has, what's her job before she moves to the daughter?
She's a maid servant in a very big mansion in Delhi, and she loses her job. And when she loses her job, she can't go to her son because he's not in a position to look after
her. To support her. Yeah.
Right. So that's one of the reasons that she breaks the taboo to go and live with her daughter. But once she gets there, she has to justify her existence. And This is a very big part of her trying to keep things the way they are. And she's always been a selector. She's always been a person who kind of keeps the status quo. And that's her job in all the circumstances. So she keeps trying to do that. And unfortunately, India's changing so fast, you can't keep the status quo.
And Anu, she's sort of, I guess, bucking the trend. She's
bucking the trend because she decides to leave her husband, but not just to go back to her parents, as many people do, and just stay married, but to actually ask for a divorce.
Yeah.
And so we go through the reasoning and the difficulty of getting a divorce, and then the dangers of getting a divorce, because it's not easy to live alone either. So she ends up trying to be a novice nun. She goes back to the convent where she grew up and where she went to school, and asks to be a Christian.
Is Catholicism big in India?
It is. It is. The church was always given a certain leg up by the British colonists. And from that point onwards, it was either the Anglican or Catholic church that became very dominant at the time. But they're no longer dominant.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, after independence, Indian Christians and the intermarried or the progeny of the British also became a minority. So Christians are a minority now, Sikhs are a minority, Muslims are a minority in India, and the majoritarian Hindu population became the dominant thing, because the dirty little secret of democracy is it's by majority.
And the time in which this book is set, the mid-90s to 10 years after, I guess, do you find that the role of women, say feminism, can that coexist with fundamentalism? And what's the role of faith in all of this?
Oh, well, you know, faith is different from the religions, of course.
Yeah.
But feminism and fundamentalism are very much in collision at this point. And fundamentalism is a misnomer, really, because you're not going back to any fundamentals of any faith unless you go back to compassion. So it's actually Hindu majoritarianism or the Aryan supremacist movement in Hinduism that was coming to the fore in the 90s. And this is what led to the nuclearization of India, because it was very much a product of the nationalism of the freedom struggle. But then after 1947, you know, this nationalism turned sour and turned into majoritarianism, to the point where, you know, after about 1991 or so, there was this sense of wounded entitlement from the upper castes of Hinduism. And they are the ones who basically said, you know, this is terrible that the lower castes are coming to prominence.
Yeah.
And that shifting of economics along with a kind of chauvinism over religion turned into something much more virulent, and something that the whole world should be afraid of.
Yeah. The two women, Damini and Anu, they come together in the book.
They do at the end, but they have their differences. They have a very different idea of when life begins, of course.
Yeah.
And they come to a kind of reconciliation of that, so that they can transcend that discussion and actually help little girls and women survive.
They're very strong women, right?
They are, because they've had to overcome certain things, but they also don't have a choice, you know? You have to be strong, because what's your choice? What are you going to do, be passive?
Yeah. As the creator of the book, as someone who's created these characters, written the book, I'm interested to know how you come to create these women. Where do they come from?
You know, if I knew that, that would be a really good thing, but and I'd bottle it and sell it, but I do think that it comes at a certain point in images and in fragments of text and in any which way one can express it. And you just keep writing that stuff down and trying to see what are the threads, where do things come together. Dhamini was actually a minor character in a short story that I wrote that was published in 1996, A Pair of Ears. And she came back and sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, tell my story. And the Memsahib in the story is from What the Body Remembers. She's just older, and it's about her sons and how they turn out.
Yeah.
So the family is the same, but then there's sort of offshoots of it.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody like Anu at all, but I know many people like her. You know? So there's the paradox always that you know something, but you don't know it. So you go exploring.
Yeah, you mentioned that these characters are from the past, from other works, and so they come to you and ask you, I guess, to write their story, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're not specifically people that you've met or anything like that.
No, they're not. But I'm sure that they have, you know, emotional content from each of them. But I don't psychoanalyze myself. I just go ahead and write.
Yeah. One of the things that the book talks about, and you've already mentioned it, is this aversion to daughters. Mm-hmm. Something like 90 million, I read, 90 million baby girls have disappeared?
Well, you know, these are estimates, and those figures have been revised downwards and upwards since the book was published, even. And it's quite strange. But I had the same problem when I wrote a story about Chernobyl. Nobody knows the figures as to how many missing girls there are. The figures, the one figure that I do trust is 160 million since the 1970s. And that is from a more recent book. And whatever the figure, it's a scandal.
Exactly.
And we need to address it. But on the other side of that, sex selection also applies to North America in a different way. Because we have social security, what's interesting is that people are actually choosing in the direction of girls.
Yeah.
So they're choosing to have girls, and when they do in vitro fertilization, or when they do PGD, which is prenatal genetic determination, they actually select in the direction of girls in North America.
Huh.
So either way, we're unbalancing the population, and we can't blame the technology. We're going to have to look at the moral choices that we're making.
The other thing that the book talks about is, it's a news situation, and it talks about domestic violence and how she addresses that in her life.
Mm-hmm.
As a writer, as a citizen, do you use the character to say something about an issue like that?
In some ways, yes, but also...
Because it seems to me that it's something that has to be written about.
It has to be written about because it's a part of our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, anything that is a part of our society should be written about. However, I also think that, you know, a novel is there to run a simulation for us. And so you run the simulation, but there's no point running a simulation and turning out just like real life.
Yeah.
You know, you miss the surprise, and you don't get anything out of reading a novel if it's just going to reflect real life. So the question is, how do people actually deal with these situations?
Yeah.
So you might set it up in about 50% of the book, but you have to actually answer the question in the second half of the book. And that is where fiction is different from real life. In real life, you can just go around and do the same thing over and over, and a lot of domestic violence situations are just that. The patterns repeat and repeat. What is interesting to me is when the patterns are broken.
Yeah. And so the pattern that's broken in this book, is that hope on your part?
Absolutely. The protagonist in question goes off and becomes a member of the Order of Everlasting Hope. Because we always have hope. And the hope is actually in the men in the book.
Yeah.
And that's where I found I had to give a lot of love to the men, because they are very broken by the fact of actually missing out on the feminine in their lives. So if they miss out on the nurturing and the caring and all of those things, they become very strange and broken men. And they're not very nice characters, but you can understand them in the book. And I think that that exploring that brokenness was also a part of my learning process through the book, you know, that this is something that is as dangerous for men to ignore mm-hmm. as it is for women.
Do you find that, because we read about domestic violence in the Indian community in this part of the world, mm-hmm. Is it the same, I mean, I don't know, this sounds silly, but I mean, is it the same sort of challenges that women have to face here as they do, say, in India?
Well, where there is community-level thinking or, you know, collective thinking, you have to break that wherever it exists.
Yeah.
So whether it's collective thinking in the direction of Aryan supremacy, or whether it's in collective thinking in the direction of the family is it and nothing is greater than the family as a unit and the individual counts for nothing, you know, either way, you are trying to break that and trying to express individuality. And I kind of think of it like making a curry, you know. You have your base of the tomato and onion base, and, mm-hmm. and that's the community you're born into. You throw in your ingredients of the meat or vegetables that are your experiences in life, but it only gets its flavor from the tarka, which is the zing.
Mm.
And that zing is the zing of individuality. And so we are challenged to actually find that individuality within the structure of the family and say, all right, we get our strengths from these traditions and from the family, but we have to be allowed, in addition, to express ourselves. And so the challenge for women is always that, because the thinking of the community is at community level. So it's like the accounting is done at that level,
mm-hmm.
and the challenge is to shift that thinking to individuality, not individualism, but individuality. Individualism would be going in the direction of, you know, me, myself, and no other. But individuality says, you know, express yourself and also enjoy the variety of people that is possible.
The other thing that we've read about you in recent weeks since the book came out was that the proximity that you have to the Gurdwara in Milwaukee,
yeah.
where those tragic events of the last
August
couple
5th,
months,
yeah.
happened.
Yeah.
You worship at that Gurdwara,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. I was on my way there, in fact. Yeah, and I had been writing for 7 years about Hindu supremacist, Aryan supremacist thinking.
Yeah,
and then this happens in my backyard, and it's a white supremacist who comes into the Gurdwara where I worship and shoots 6 people, wounds another 4 or 5, shoots up the cars in the parking lot, and you know, it just came home. The whole scenario was just very unsettling and terrible.
Yeah. Having thought about hate, as you have in your writing and so on, mm-hmm. over the years, and then when it comes home, like it did in August, do you understand it more?
I think that it's something that is not about hate. It's about economic justifications. Okay, so economics is changing the way in which privileged people have access to resources like jobs and things like that. How they express that frustration or that taking away of privilege is really the issue here. It's not about hate.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons for hate are the taking away of their privileges and of the loss of their entitlement. The problem is that sense of entitlement. And if we don't address that sense of entitlement and say, you know what, you're not greater or less than anybody else, you deserve no better or no less than anybody else, but we're raising people wrong then. We're raising people with this sense of entitlement, this sense of even within our community, raising people with a sense of we and them. Well, that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to address that form of thinking instead of saying, well, it's all about hate and why do they hate us. Well, that's not a productive question. The question is, why do they feel so entitled?
Mm-hmm. What I found poignant was that you're at home, you're getting dressed to go there,
mm-hmm.
and you hear the news of the day,
yeah.
and you still go there, and you're there for 5 hours, right?
Oh, we were there waiting for news for trying to figure out what was happening. We didn't know if there was one shooter or 10.
Yeah.
We had no idea. The whole of southeastern Wisconsin's emergency system went into operation right away. There were 6 armored cars patrolling that street. We had no idea if they needed help, if food was necessary for the people who were waiting outside over there, you know, translation assistance. We were just trying to help each other by being there, I think, you know. Whatever it was, we were in it together.
Yeah, and so when you think about that, and then you think about the themes in the book about the emerging India, are you generally a hopeful person?
Of course, because you know when you look at the strategies that people have in which to deal with which they deal with some of these situations, you realize how creative they are. And you admire them for the ways in which they're doing it, which are within the tradition. They are not the way that somebody like me in North America would address the situation. I would talk about my rights, for example, mm-hmm. right away. They don't talk about rights. They talk about duties.
Yeah.
And they talk about duties because they're still coming out of a feudal system. They're still not in that area of talking about rights. It's only North Americans who talk about rights, you know.
Yeah.
But they know the language with which to reframe their requests and their persuasions and their demands, really, to come across to people and say, we're not complaining, but you better do this because it's your duty.
Yeah.
So it's a very different language than you or I would use in this country, but it's very effective.
Yeah.
And I think as tactics, we need to look at these tactics and say, can we replicate some of these, you know, in other environments?
The reaction to the book, the reviews have been quite good.
Good.
Do you think that this book will be read in India, say, differently than it is here in North America?
You know what? The books all look alike, but they tell a different story to each person. It depends on what background you bring to it. It depends on whether you think the glass is half empty or the glass is half full. You know, there's so many different ways in which to talk about it, because I've already talked about this book on different programs in many different directions, whether it's on a Jewish program, for instance. We talked about the Aryan supremacist thing. As far as the angle, on a feminist show, I talked about it from a women's perspective. I could talk about the whole book from a masculine perspective as well.
Yeah.
And then, what about the technology perspective? I did a science show in which I talked about the technology and nuclearization. So, you know, it depends on what somebody gets out of the book, also what somebody needs from the book they will get.
And it's a book that everyone can read, right?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some very funny parts and you know, this Apollo scene, for instance, and a spirit possession and stuff. And I mean, there's some things that you wouldn't normally come across.
Yeah. When you're on book tour like this, because this is a grueling book tour that you're on, do you find the time to write?
I do, actually. I'm kind of in this strange place. I was telling my publicist recently that when you go without sleep, sometimes you enter a kind of trance state.
Really?
And so I feel like Proust lying in bed and writing sometimes, but you do get into a zone sometimes, and that's beautiful. And whenever you get it, whether it's an hour or 2 hours, take it.
Yeah.
You know?
And so you write on paper, I guess. You don't use a computer?
Well, recently I've been writing on paper. I really don't consider the medium. If I'm at a computer, I use the computer. I've been in IT for 30 years, so I think through the computer. I don't even think about whether I'm doing it on a computer or not. So it's whatever comes to hand, just create.
Yeah. And was this a fun book to write?
Very, actually.
Yeah.
Not all of it. Some parts of it were very tough to write. Yes. Sometimes I still cry at certain parts. However, I think they're so creative that you have to have fun with it, especially when they're changing religions and they're trying very hard to meet all of the expectations and they're not quite doing it right.
Yeah.
So I understand them. I don't necessarily condone a lot of the things that they do. And the most difficult parts, I think, were the parts about people whose value system is completely different from mine, you know, who value exclusion and who value chauvinism and who value religion at the price of anything, you know. These are very hard people to relate to. And I found that there were two men in the book like that, and I found it very difficult to write those parts because they're misogynist, you know? So I had to find a lot of love at that point and work through it because that's what the story needs.
Yeah. It's been a real pleasure to meet you and an honor to talk to you today. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. The website for more, ShaunaSinghBaldwin.com. The book is called The Selector of Souls. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Shauna Singh Baldwin, joined me in the studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.